This hour, as we continue chatting with Dan Wright about his work, the CIA UFO papers, will also take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you 10 minutes after the hour on Coast to Coast. And among the people you acknowledge here, Dan, in your book is Dr. J. Allen Hynek. He did end up being a hero, didn't he?
Yes. It's curious about J. Allen. And I was privileged one night in the 70s to spend an entire evening with him and regale him about a couple of investigations I had.
Swamp gas, right?
Yeah, right. But yes, he was called to the scene when Michigan in 1965 had a couple of nights of wild stories from Southeast and South Michigan around a couple of small towns.
Dexter, Michigan, wasn't it?
Dexter was the first one, and then Hillsdale at Hillsdale College,
yep,
where, as well as a couple of university administrators, they had 87 girls from the dorm at Hillsdale to see these lights over a swamp. It was a marsh. And so Hynek was called in when this was making headlines all over the papers. And after 2 days, he said, of chaotic interviews, he coined the unfortunate term swamp gas.
Now, I am told, Dan, that he was told to say that. Did you ever hear that story?
No, I did not hear that.
Yeah.
He was ordered to say that.
He apparently had to take a phone call. They said, Dr. Hynek, they're calling you from Washington. And he took a call in a room, came back, looked ticked off, and then announced to the media that it was swamp gas.
Yeah. I would be the first in line to say that Hynek was no true believer. He was, to the very end, the hard-nosed scientist. But he did go from being a debunker in the early 50s when he joined the Air Force's cause to finally, in 1973, formed his own group, the Center for UFO Studies.
That's right.
Which bears his name today.
And it was that case of Lonnie Zamora, the police officer in Socorro, New Mexico, that helped change his mind.
Yes. Zamora was chasing a speeder when he saw a flash of both blue and orange flames in the sky off the road. And so he just drove his cruiser over the desert terrain until he came upon this egg-shaped object resting on the ground with a couple of little white-suited grays outside the vehicle. When they spotted him, they raced back in, and with a rumbling, roaring sound, it took off again. But it left both depressions and scorch marks, and he brought in his police superior to verify what had happened there. I don't think that this was a good moment in Mr. Zamora's life. He's been featured on many, many documentaries since, but he paid a price of, among his colleagues, he was for a while a laughingstock.
Well, that's true, too. That's absolutely true. So an amazing cases, though, over the years. We don't seem to get them anymore. Why is that? Am I right?
Well, there's always something going on. And, if you count up MUFON statistics in a year's time, there's going to be 1,000 or 2,000 cases from shaky to solid.
I mean, the last really good one, and I'm not talking about the release of the Tic Tac aircraft case or anything like that, but the real last great case where there were witnesses was the Phoenix Lights, and that was 22 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was seen by so many that, as you probably can't make a statement for what the government said about the Phoenix Lights, because they didn't say much.
Not much. Flares and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, they actually, what it appears that they did was, after the fact, late at night, they sent a couple of helicopters up to drop some flares and say that's what people misidentified. But they were off by about an hour and a half from what really happened.
Let's take some calls here for you, Dan. Let's pick it up by going to Bill in North Carolina, first-time caller. Hello there, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you guys very much for allowing me to put a little input here.
Sure,
may not have a lot to add, but I would like to say when I was in the Air Force, 1966 to 69.
Thank you, too, by the way.
Well, thank you very much. I was at Luke Air Force Base, and Luke Air Force Base, I was a radar operator. And we saw it was part of the SAGE environment, semi-automatic ground environment, so it was kind of a computerized system at the time. And we would have objects on radar that was the speed of the object was so fast it couldn't keep up. It couldn't keep up with the data input, and they were definitely unknown. Now, I'm just an enlisted guy, so I don't have a lot to add, but there definitely was unidentified objects on radar. And then when I got to Iceland, I went to Iceland for 1 year. I was a crew chief up there, and then we would have objects again on radar, but that was a manual system. It was not a computerized system. And we would have objects, and maintenance would tell us sometimes that it was called, there was a term called running rabbits. And so I definitely have seen objects on radar with my own eyes that was unidentifiable. Then when I left Iceland, went to the command post at Otis Air Force Base, and one of my jobs there was to take UFO reports. When someone would call in, it was nothing. We'd just take a sheet of paper that had questions on it, and we would just ask the questions, and we'd put it in a book. And I don't remember all the questions, but questions like if you saw an object and you held your fist straight out, in relationship to your
at
fist
arm's
and that
length.
Object, right, at arm's length. That's like one of the questions we asked. And I've always joked about this when I was in college and in my career with other buddies when we were sitting around talking. I said, you know, I think there was a question, the best I remember, there was a question on there that today probably wouldn't fly, but there was a question on there, have you been drinking? I'm pretty sure there was a question on there like that, but I just wanted to add that I firsthand saw stuff on radar that was unidentifiable.
Did you ever scramble? Did you have to scramble any jets to catch them?
We scrambled jets, but it was to intercept the Soviets coming over the ADIZ. But we didn't scramble on any unknown objects. If we scrambled, we knew pretty much what we were going after.
Yeah, I believe that. That's a great story. Thank you. And I wonder how many operators of radar units, Dan, could say exactly what he did.
I'm reminded of one, some radar that was on board an airliner, which radioed in to say that something was approaching him and was going what the equivalent would be of 10,800 miles an hour, that it covered like 24 kilometers in a number of seconds, and that it was going so fast that on their radar screen it was leaving a trail. That was a favorite of mine.
Let's go to Joe in the Bronx. Welcome to the program, Joseph.
Hey, George. How are you?
Always well. Thanks, Joe.
Good, good. Yeah, Dan, among the files that you reviewed, were there any files having to do with either Roswell, attack over L.A., or the Eisenhower meetings with ETs?
No, none of those things was covered by the CIA. I had 550 CIA reports or documents, but what I found early on in the process of going through all of them and separating wheat from chaff was if it had anything to do with national security, it was not eventually put on the CIA website. Then those were held in abeyance, and I have some really good cases from around the world that the CIA must have known about, but because it involved their personnel or those of friendly nations and was peculiar, that was a national security interest, and it went nowhere.
Dan, let's talk a little bit about Dr. James McDonnell. What was his role in all of this?
He's a favorite and a hero to me. Dr. McDonald was an atmospheric physicist at the University of Arizona. And however he came to this, in October of 66, the newspaper, the Arizona Republic, ran an article titled UFO Hush Blamed on CIA Men. Dr. McDonald was a hardcore scientist, but he would tell audiences that he came to the ET hypothesis as the least unacceptable explanation. he rejected things like time travel and ESP and secret aircraft and natural phenomena as overall explanations. Well, he went after the CIA because when he was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, he looked at that old 1953 Robertson Panel report, and at that point, there was a memo attached from the CIA to the Air Force ordering the Air Force to debunk future cases. And so he really came down with both fists on the CIA over that. He made a number of appearances before various audiences, and was, to the CIA, he was a real pain in the butt. And eventually, because of his public speaking on this subject and repeatedly saying the CIA was lying and the Air Force was debunking at the CIA's behest, he ran into trouble with his university superiors and also at home, and he eventually took his own life.
Ugh, horrible. He couldn't take it anymore, could he?
Yeah, he just couldn't handle that much pressure. But to me, he was an unsung hero.
The Condon report that came out in 67, 68 to debunk Project Blue Book, that was a setup, wasn't it?
It sure was. By 67, the Air Force was ready to punt. They didn't have an answer to everything, and neither could they get rid of it. So they asked for another committee to be set up, and this was under Edward Condon, a physicist at
Colorado State or something.
University of Colorado.
University, yeah.
He put together four other physicists and three psychologists to go over, not a large number, but a number of cases. And I put down a couple of quotes here that I think are worthy of mention. The chief of staff, in effect, was another physicist named Dr. Robert Lowe from UC. He told university officials just as they were getting underway in late 67, our study would be conducted almost exclusively by non-believers who would add an impressive body of evidence that there is no real reality to the observations. And then the key, he said, the trick would be, I think, to describe it so that to the public it would appear to be a totally objective study, but to the scientific community it would present the image of a group of non-believers trying their best to be objective, but having an almost zero chance of finding a saucer.
Next up, so carry
that's
it.
The objectivity of Dr. Robert Lowe. And Condon himself said, I won't believe in outer space saucers until I see one, touch one, haul it into a laboratory, and get some competent people to go over it with me.
Tell them to go to Area 51.
He also told the press early on, this is in the first couple of months of the Condon Committee's existence, it is my inclination right now to recommend that the government get out of the business. My attitude right now is that there is nothing to it, but I'm not supposed to reach a conclusion for another year.
We've got Harry in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to the show. Hi, Harry.
How are you, George? Good to speak with you again.
You
love
too,
your show.
Sir. Thank you.
You got a great show. You really do. I saw a program on television a while back about UFOs. And there was a gentleman who claimed that he had come across the craft, spacecraft, mm-hmm. and that he found this piece of metal. It was about a foot long. It was squared off on it, the edges, on the sides and everything, and it had symbols on it. And he didn't know what to make of it, you know. And he it was silver in color, by the way. And he showed it on the show. And what happened was somehow the Air Force, he was telling people about it, and the Air Force or the Army came to his house because they had heard he was talking about it. He had the piece, and they decided that they wanted to borrow it and test it, and they would give it back to him. And so they borrowed it, and they tested it.
And never gave it back to him.
Never gave it back.
No. He got it back. But wait. What happened was, he might have had to go to, I don't remember, it was a while back, the show. He might have had to go to court to get it back. But he did get it back. But the thing was, they tested it with heat, couldn't burn it. They tried to cut it. They couldn't cut it. And they had linguistics come in, and I think what you call them linguistics, whatever you would call them. They tried to decipher the symbols. They couldn't do that either. I think it was about a year they held on to it, and somehow, I don't know if it was through courts or whatever the case may be, they gave it back to him. And he showed it on the show. And it did have these weird symbols on it. It was a foot long, like he said, and it was silver in color. And there was no scratches or marks on it. So so as far as I know, this is some kind of a object that's definitely alien to Earth. What do you think? Have you ever heard of this story before?
No, I have not. When I hear the particulars like that of something very strange, my mind goes in two directions. Either this is the most fantastic account of all time, or it's a hoax. Now, I have an account in return that has been a part of documentaries a number of times. That was the 1984 Bentwaters England case, where the deputy base commander went out with a couple of his airmen into a woods on the edge of the base, where there was a pyramidal, a pyramid, but small, like a doghouse kind of small, resting in on the edge of the woods. And that had strange symbols on it as well. Not that they tried to or ever could decipher them, but here was the deputy base commander saying, "I was there and I saw it too."
Dan, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM and take some final calls. So those of you on hold, just hang there. Those of you making the calls, we'll get to you as well. The name of the book, The CIA UFO Papers, written by Dan Wright. Dramatic book about these incredible cases. And if you're into UFOs, this is one of the most complete books I have ever read on the subject matter. So stick around and do that. He does not have a website available, but he's part of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. So stick with us. And by the way, don't forget to like us on Facebook and do follow us on Twitter, where we send out little messages every day. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Final segment, Dan Wright with us, and the book is The CIA UFO Papers. Dan, where do people get the book?
It's on Amazon now.
Perfect.
The publisher is Red Wheel Weiser, W-E-I-S-E-R, or just RWW Books. And as of yesterday, it's available. I don't know what the price is. Probably a tad over $20.
It's hot off the presses, though, huh?
And it is a MUFON-sponsored book. Though I wrote it, MUFON and I are sort of publishing it, I guess, through RWW, and MUFON will get 2/3 of the profits.
MUFON's a great organization, and I'm impressed where you dedicated this to the memory of Walter Endress Jr., the co-founder of MUFON.
Yes, he was my mentor and a good friend.
He's a great guy. And he believed. Did you notice where Elon Musk is saying we're not being visited?
that.
Yeah, he said, just said that in the last day or two, and he said he'd know it if we were.
He being at the center of the universe and all.
Exactly. Exactly. What do you say to people who just don't believe we're being visited? And it's their opinion. I mean, they're entitled to it.
Of course. And I'm not going to debate it to the bitter end with somebody who just can't accept it. I think, first of all, about what would some of the short-range problems be for our society if there were an undeniable acceptance of a UFO presence, even if they weren't here to trample all over us or something, just watching from above, but undeniably so that the government had to say, yeah, they're up there, we can't do anything about them. Well, what would happen first? The stock market and currencies would take a tumble because they hate uncertainty.
Yes.
But also, exactly, some of the religions would have a whole lot more problems than others, and especially Christianity. The more dogmatic the denomination, the worse the fears among the faithful would be.
Well, I think the Catholic Church is being smart, kind of leaking out their intentions about UFOs.
Being a little more progressive than others.
Yep.
But, you know, the Bible doesn't mention alien beings. It does have a mention in Revelations that the supposed quote, "and I will grant wonders in the sky above." But really, Jesus was supposed to be the only begotten Son. Well, if that's the case, who are these guys? So Christianity in general would have a problem. Judaism and Islam are still monotheistic, and so they might have a problem accepting. But, say, Hinduism, which is polytheistic, or Buddhism, which is non-theistic, they might just say, yeah, well, just another thing to put up with.
All right, let's go back for final calls. We'll pick it up by going to Mark in Maryland, east of the Rockies. Hi, Mark. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, George. And Mr. Wright, I really appreciate you giving this interview. It's been fascinating.
Thank you.
I'm retired Navy, and a long, long time ago, decades ago, I handled message traffic. I was given a top secret clearance, and I handled message traffic. I happened to come across a book in a bookstore that I bought, and there was a chapter in there about the MJ-12 papers, and there were very nice photographs, full-size photographs of the MJ-12 papers, the Twining letter, the Truman letter, the briefing message, and the thing that was prepared for President-elect Eisenhower naming the MJ-12.
Right.
So I believe, since I've handled message traffic, I looked at those very carefully, and in my own mind, I feel that the papers are genuine, and all I wanted to do was ask you what your thoughts were.
They look genuine to you, all right. I don't know. It created quite a stir within MUFON for probably a couple of years that Truman in 47 actually set up this Majestic 12 group to look into the UFO business. Whatever Majestic 12 meant, I never heard of any people filling out one of those names. And whether it was real or not, I don't know. But it surely made a stir.
Okay, very good. Well said. Dan, let's take a few more calls. Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Wayne, go ahead, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. Sir George.
Hey.
And my guest, I wanted to make a comment, first of all. You know, we think of this as a super above top secret, but I think the most super above top secret is something that Ben Rich talked about. You know, he said, anything you can imagine that you see on Star Trek, we have it and better. And, of course, one of the high-tech things in Star Trek, maybe the most high-tech thing, and I think maybe still the most high-tech thing around, is teleportation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, And that's just my comment. The question that I have is about hard evidence. I'm always looking for hard evidence. I think there's a number of cases. You mentioned the Zamora case that shows some hard evidence. Reynolds and Forest, I think that's pretty good hard evidence. I think the Shag Harbor is actually one of the very best of all hard evidence cases. And I would really like to see a book out there on all the hard evidence cases kind of put together in one book. I don't know if I don't think anybody's done that yet. Can you comment on that, Ed?
Yeah, you're probably right. If a book were to concentrate on strictly those that had some form of physical evidence, there was a MUFON member way back, I'm not thinking of his, Ted Phillips, that was his name. He put together over the years, meaning the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, some 2,000 cases where he did write-ups of cases that had physical evidence, physical extending to radar returns.
And burned out cornfields and things like that.
Yeah, scorching depressions, that kind of thing. He never wrote a book up on it, as far as I know, but I was impressed that he had made that into his avocation.
We have Paul in Highland, California now, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi, George. This is my first time.
Well, thanks.
You had a gentleman on a while back that had mentioned that President Eisenhower went aboard a UFO in Southern California near one of the Air Force bases. And I think back, I'm 79, I think back, and when I was about 14 or 15, my mother had a friend that was a medium, and she came from back east to California here to visit for a while, and she used to give us kids light readings, as she called them, and we got on the subject of UFOs. And that lady said President Eisenhower came out here a while back and went aboard a UFO. Well, we all laughed as kids. We thought that was funny.
Huh.
Well,
here being
long after where? That, a gentleman down the street, his cousin came. He was in the air police at one of the desert Air Force bases.
Yeah.
And he said, we mentioned it to him. We were teenagers, you know. He says, how the hell did you know about that? And I have always remembered that. And when that came up on the air a couple of months ago with you guys, it almost stood my hair on end because I remembered it.
That's a great story.
Yeah, that's that's almost a verification of what he said.
Go ahead, Dan.
I don't recall the actual source, and I don't think of this as being way out west. I'm thinking something more like Nebraska, and I don't recall if Eisenhower was yet president. He may have been just still General Eisenhower, but I heard a story through MUFON way back that he and the company of a couple of other folks had stood on the perimeter of an airbase, I think, and seen a landed saucer and maybe saw the beings. I never heard that he actually boarded one, but I did hear rather convincingly that he, from a short distance, did look upon a ship and its occupants.
Let's go to Mira in Los Angeles. Hello, Mira. Welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Thank you so much. And
sure.
Hello to your guest. So I am not a UFO buff, but I have had my sightings, my encounters. So I just wanted to tell you this story that I've actually been trying to build up the courage to tell you for a while.
Okay.
It freaked me out quite a bit, to be honest. But, you know, and also I wasn't listening to Coast to Coast back then, so I didn't realize that all of you were out there.
We and, are here. Oh, yes.
So, okay, this was, it was probably 2015, give or take a year. It was Christmas morning, just after midnight. And I was reaching for my coat to go take a bike ride. And right then the power went out. And I'm right in the heart of Los Angeles. I'm right by Dodger Stadium.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So So I go out to take this bike ride to see what's going on and why the power's off. And I ride down the hill, and I look up, and the sky is, you know, it's a murky kind of like orangish color, you know. And I see this this ghost streak above me, not very high above me. It was quite low, and which I believe was a UFO. It was like a ghost flash. It was moving so fast. And so during that period, there was a lot of helicopter activity, and I was actually so shaken by the experience, I didn't even bother to go check to see if it was coming from Dodger Stadium. But it was a weird time. A lot of helicopter activity, a lot of movement going, you know, north to the stadium, then back south. But somebody proposed a theory to me that possibly the power going out had to do with maybe the UFO powering up. But that experience, I just made the assumption that the government and these crafts are already united and working together.
What do you think of that, Dan?
Oh, gosh. That would be, the ultimate cover-up, I guess.
Do you think they're working together?
No, I do not. But it may not be a matter of dreaded enemies either. It may be live and let live.
Turn your cheek the other way?
The notion that our government is working in cooperation with one or more entity types. And again, there's multiple types out there. This is not a singular UFO alien type thing. So, but the lady reminds me of something else about electricity going out. With automobiles back in the 60s on a particular night where there were all kinds of encounters around a town in West Texas and in other events as well, the motorist's car suddenly quits. The lights go out as well. He coasts to a halt, and there's, say, a saucer or a cylinder hovering nearby. And the spooky ones to me are that after it leaves, in most cases, the person then can then restart the car. But the ones that really I find spooky are when the UFO leaves, the car restarts by itself.
By itself. Close encounters of the third kind. Huh? Let's go to Mike in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Squeeze you in, Mike. We've got a minute left. Go ahead.
I'll try to be quick, Mr. Norrie.
Sure.
1985, January 1985, I was in the Persian Gulf, U.S. Navy. On a lookout, we saw some lights. Couldn't describe, we couldn't figure out what the lights were. They went straight from 000 to 90 degrees to the port, then 90 degrees to the starboard. The reason I mentioned is you talked about evidence or witnesses. It was entered into the deck log as it was completely inexplicable. there's nothing that could have moved that fast back then. And then in 6 years later, fast forward 6 years, January 16th, 1991, Gulf War, we're getting ready to invade Iraq. Same lights occur in where we were off the coast. We had to halt all activity because we had a foul range because of these lights. Nothing showed up on radar. We couldn't determine what it was. It was going back and forth across the sky at a high rate of speed. Nothing on radar. Ultimately, it just went straight up in the air and disappeared, and we continued the, we'll just call them exercises.
Well, first of all, thank you for serving. And secondly, of course, Dan, we hear so many incredible stories of UFO cases from our military, particularly Navy folks, who sometimes see the lights underwater. They're incredible. But good luck with this book, The CIA UFO Papers with Dan Wright. It's an amazing series of stories. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borles, Tim Badal, and George Knapp. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.